طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. This morning, we focus on Omar Barghouti, one of the founders and current leaders of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions campaign. The movement has enjoyed enormous success throughout the world, so much success that it has become the major target of the Israeli propaganda machine. As part of that campaign, stopping the BDS movement has even become a major goal of a legislative strategy in the United States, both at the national and state level, including Massachusetts, where current anti-BDS legislation is pending at the State House. The major Palestinian voice of the BDS movement is Omar Barghouti, who Israel is attempting to silence by arresting and detaining him. Israel wants to stop his traveling throughout the world, speaking, organizing, and promoting the BDS movement, which is playing an enormous role in isolating Israel and portraying it as a pariah nation. And it is working. If it were not, Israel would not be going all out to stop it. This past week, Palestinian professor Haider Eid from Gaza wrote the following about the current Israeli assault on Omar Barghouti. Quote, "Omar Barghouti, one of the most charismatic Palestinian activists, has been subjected to the most intense interrogation by Israeli authorities. He is the outspoken co-founder of the BDS movement, member of the Secretariat of the Boycott National Committee, and a steering committee member of the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel. Israeli forces kidnapped Omar to prevent him from traveling to the United States to receive the prestigious Gandhi Peace Award. They are holding him with false, trumped-up charges as part of their current tactic to start lies and rumors to tarnish the image of BDS activists and discredit the BDS movement. This attack on Omar is not new, but part of Israel's all-out legal, intelligence, and propaganda war on the BDS movement, which has intensified since 2016. This intensified focus on the BDS movement is a reaction to the increasing success of the nonviolent BDS movement, which has seen Israeli ships being prevented from docking in ports across the world, hundreds of artists and musicians refusing to perform in Israel, and prominent South African freedom fighters such as Ahmed Kathrada, Archbishop Tutu, and Rani Kasriels aligning themselves with the BDS movement and declaring Israeli apartheid to be far worse than that endured by South Africans. But it knows very well the success that BDS is achieving globally, and that BDS is the new old tool of resistance used by the Palestinians, supported by international civil society, to bring Israel to justice and hold it accountable for all the crimes it has been committing against the Palestinian people, namely occupation, colonization, and apartheid. This is a global movement with global supporters, with a focus on eliminating oppression and injustice in Palestine, but with an address that goes far beyond Palestine and out of the reach of Israel's usual barbaric tool of war crimes and crimes against humanity, including mass murder and collective punishment. Omar's statements and positions emanate from the movement's defense of Palestinian human rights. Its slogans, freedom, equality, and justice, pose a very serious threat to the racist foundation of Israel as, quote, the state of the Jews, unquote. Put differently, to call for equality and return of refugees who were ethnically cleansed in 1948, in accordance with the UN Resolution 194, and as the BDS movement does, questions the very definition of the State of Israel, as made clear by the ultimately repressed United Nations report by its Economic and Social Commission for Western Asia, which clearly states that it is an apartheid state. To be willing to recognize and accept the exclusivist and racist nature of the state is the precondition for being welcomed in Israel. There is no Israeli nationality, only a Jewish national character and not an Israeli one, which effectively excludes all Palestinians and non-Jews living in Israel from citizenship and statehood. This, as noted by the UN Committee on Social, Economic, and Cultural Rights, quote, encourages discrimination and accords second-class status to Israel's non-Jewish citizens, unquote. It is very obvious that the ruling Ashkenazi establishment has become fed up with the rising tsunami of the BDS movement. Last year's Yediot Aronot conference, which was attended by all spectrums of political life in Israel, reached the conclusion that the movement poses a strategic, if not an existential, threat to the Zionist project in the Middle East. Hence, the extremist measures taken by the government and laws passed by the Knesset to fight BDS. One of those measures was civil targeted killing of BDS activists. Unsurprisingly, 2 weeks ago, the Israeli Knesset passed a resolution to ban all foreign BDS activists and supporters from entering the country. Interestingly, and in accordance with the apartheid South African experience, no Jewish activist has ever been subjected to the kind of treatment Palestinian activists experience at the hands of the authorities. The response to activism is also subsumed to the racist ideology that informs the political statements and actions of Israel and Israeli politicians. A meaningful, just, and comprehensive solution to the Palestinian question must include all Palestinians, including those in the West Bank and Gaza, those who remained in Israel, and the 1948 Palestinian refugees. The mechanism to redress this disposition is not via a Bantustan a la apartheid South Africa, as agreed to by the signatories of the Oslo Accords. Instead, a secular, democratic state where all citizens are treated equally, regardless of their religion, sex, or color, is the only just and equitable solution that will end Israeli apartheid. This is what Omar has been calling for, and what he continues to call for in his latest statement. This steadfastness of the BDS movement and its unwavering commitment to justice for all Palestinians is the real reason behind the false campaign against Omar Barghouti. And this is why the BDS movement must, as Omar has called for, intensified its work, so that Israel is forced to comply with international law. More BDS is on the way to end apartheid in Israel as apartheid was ended in South Africa. Unquote. And that is the end of the article, written by Haider Eid, professor and journalist who writes from Gaza. Since Israel at the moment has silenced Omar Barghouti by detaining him, it seems fitting that we feature his voice this morning. And so the following is a lecture he gave at Portland State University. Here is Omar Barghouti.
I'll share with you some thoughts about the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, how it started, what its aims are, and how it connects to some of the discussion that's been taking place tonight. Roosevelt said, "A conquest may be fraught with evil or with good for mankind, according to the comparative worth of the conquering and conquered peoples." End of quote. So savages fits right there. A very important Zionist thinker, Ze'ev Jabotinsky, in the pre-state era of Zionism, he was the far-right reform Zionism brand of the movement, wrote the following in a very important article titled The Iron Wall. He wrote, "It is utterly impossible to obtain the voluntary consent of the Palestine Arabs for converting Palestine from an Arab country into a country with a Jewish majority." He carries on, "The native populations, civilized or uncivilized," of course we're not civilized, but regardless, "have always stubbornly resisted the colonists, irrespective of whether they were civilized or savage." So in a nutshell, Jabotinsky was basically saying that Zionism has to defeat hope in the colonized nation, the Palestinians, in order to force an agreement on them. You cannot get their consent to accept colonization. No one accepts colonization. People are not stupid, actually, he says. He says those so-called liberal Zionists are very racist. They think Arabs are dumb and we can bribe them. They cannot be bribed. Like any colonized nation, they will resist us. So we've got to kill their hope with massive power. And the Iron Wall strategy of Jabotinsky lives on till today in Zionism. But it has taken many shapes, from the concrete wall in the occupied territory to the metaphorical wall that Israel has built in our minds. So some very similar experiences have been shared by the indigenous people of this land, of Canada, and so on. The colonizers succeed when they kill hope in the colonized, and part of doing that is by colonizing our minds and convincing us that we are worthless beings, relative, what I call relative humans, that is, humans only in the relative sense. So you don't deserve the full set of rights because you're not really a full human, and you have no hope in defeating this progress machine, this massive power. So you might as well adapt. We in the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which was launched in 2005, felt otherwise, that to resist hopelessness, we've got to have massive hope. But this hope has to be built on a real strategy that can succeed, not wishful thinking. Quite often, the oppressed wish oppression away, but that's hardly helpful. Wishing something is okay, so long as you translate that into a strategy, so that you understand your reality, you reflect on it, and you act to change it. That's exactly what we did when we launched the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement in 2005, building on a very long heritage of Palestinian resistance to settler colonialism, and building on the experiences of the South African fight against oppression, the civil rights movement in the United States, the anti-colonial struggles in India and many other places around the world, and definitely on the heroism of the indigenous people who survived the genocide in this land. The BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, launched in 2005, called for three basic rights without which we cannot achieve self-determination: ending the occupation of 1967, including the wall and the colonies, ending Israel's system of racial discrimination, which meets the United Nations definition of apartheid, and I'll explain that in a minute, and the right of return for Palestinian refugees. Someone might ask, why did you insist on all three rights rather than just ending the occupation, which is easier? We all understand that. It's nice to be convenient, but that's not our main concern. Our main concern are the rights of our people. And the Palestinian people, around 11.8 million of us, do not all live in the occupied Palestinian territory of 1967. In fact, only 38% of the Palestinians live in Gaza and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. 12% are Palestinian citizens of the State of Israel, and a whole 50% are Palestinians in exile, not allowed to go home simply because they're the wrong type. They're not Jewish. So any person interested in human rights and is consistent with herself or himself would call for the basic rights of all three communities, not just the most convenient, those living under occupation in the 1967 territory. That's why BDS calls for ending the occupation, ending apartheid, and the right of return for Palestinian refugees. Going back to the issue of apartheid, because it's one of the most controversial issues, people ask us, when you say Israel is guilty of apartheid, on top of being a settler colonial state and an occupying power, which we can discuss or debate, but it's the apartheid crime that sticks out. And people say, are you saying that Israel is identical with South Africa? Palestinians in Israel can vote. Blacks in South Africa could never vote. So they're not the same. And blacks in South Africa were the majority, and Palestinians in Israel are a minority. Some very big intellectuals in this country on the left use this argument to argue that Israel cannot be an apartheid state. But it seems big intellectuals on the left or the right seem to be missing one main reference. I know in the US international law sounds like Swahili, but to the rest of the world it means something. International law defines the crime of apartheid in the 1973 Convention for the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid, and in the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. Apartheid as a crime is not just a South African crime. It definitely existed in South Africa, but it's a universal crime. You had it in the US, you just did not call it apartheid then. In the Jim Crow South, that was very much an apartheid reality. It wasn't called apartheid because apartheid came into existence later. But it's systematic oppression by one racial group against another that is legalized and institutionalized. So racial discrimination alone is not yet apartheid. When it's entrenched, when it's institutionalized in law, when it's legalized, then it becomes apartheid. When you have laws that discriminate against a subset of your citizenry based on their identity, that's apartheid. That's exactly what Israel has today. Other than what Israel is doing in the West Bank and Gaza, which is obviously apartheid, within Israel's own supposed borders, Israel has no borders, but within the pre-67 borders of the State of Israel, Israel has more than 50 discriminatory laws that treat its non-Jewish citizens as a second-class citizen. So they get lesser rights by law, not by policy only, by law. And that's the key point. So Israel is a regime of occupation, settler colonialism, as well as apartheid. In fact, President Obama himself kind of recognized that issue. In an interview with Jeffrey Goldberg, he said, in fact, that Israel's, this is a paraphrase of what he told Jeffrey Goldberg, if Israel doesn't disentangle itself from the lives of the West Bank Palestinians, the world will one day decide it is behaving as an apartheid state. John Kerry went further than that, and he explicitly used the term apartheid in 2014, last year, when he said Israel can become an apartheid state like the old South Africa if it did not reach peace with the so-called peace with the Palestinians. Regardless, the rest of the world is increasingly recognizing Israel's regime of oppression for what it is. The issue of apartheid is at the forefront of this definition of Israel's regime. In fact, in a couple of weeks, Israeli Apartheid Week is an international event that's happening across campuses around the world, more than 200 cities around the world, that recognizes Israel as an apartheid state. Israel's standing in world public opinion has suffered tremendously for two main factors. One factor is Israel's own regime shifting to the far right and doing away, losing any masks of democracy. Israel was never a democratic state, a colonial power that practices apartheid, that has laws that discriminate, and so can never be a democracy. Yet it had a very compelling mask of democracy and a huge media operation that projected that mask of democracy. With the current far-right Israeli government, they've dropped the mask. So they've helped a lot. And I've said that before, and I'll say it again, you've got to give credit where credit belongs. Without Netanyahu, we couldn't have done it this fast. A BBC Globe Scan poll, which is an international public opinion poll, for the last number of years has consistently shown Israel competing with North Korea in popularity. On the third or fourth worst perceived country in the world, according to the BBC poll, is Israel. North Korea comes a notch lower than that. And this is not just in countries like Brazil, India, Egypt, the global south that naturally supports Palestinians. This is across Europe. Two-third majorities across Europe's largest nations perceive Israel negatively. Germany, France, Italy, Britain, and Spain, and so on. In fact, even in the U.S., not yet a majority, but things are shifting. According to recent polls, a CNN poll a couple of weeks ago, two-thirds of Americans believe that the U.S. government should be neutral in the so-called Palestinian-Israeli conflict. You wouldn't think so, looking at Congress or reading the mainstream media. Two-thirds want the U.S. to be neutral, neither pro-Israel nor pro-Palestinian. Imagine. And if you dig deeper into some of those polls in 2014, close to 40% of Americans support sanctions against Israel because of the settlement issue. 40%, 4 out of 10. Among what the poll calls Hispanics, the percentage is highest. It's about 44%. Of Latino Americans support sanctions against Israel because of the occupation and settlements. Among Jewish Americans, 15% of Jewish Americans support boycott of Israeli products. 25% support boycott of settlement products. But imagine, 15% support a full boycott. That's why JVP is growing. There is a constituency there that no longer blindly supports Israel, even among Jewish Americans. That's a very important trend that we must see. Among young Democrats, there are more people supporting Palestinians than supporting Israel. Young Democrats, the Democratic Party, imagine. Hardly Democratic, but that's what they call themselves. Recently, Israel's foreign ministry distributed a paper to its diplomatic missions across the world, saying that 2015 will see even further isolation of Israel. This theme of isolation has been repeating itself for the last couple of years or so. John Kerry threatened Israel that if you don't reach peace, that was last year, with the Palestinians, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is around the corner, and it's getting stronger and stronger. He actually said that. Obama hinted at it. He said Israel might face a very fast-growing isolation if it did not reach some settlement with the Palestinians. The Israeli government, since June 2013, started looking at BDS as a strategic threat to its entire regime. Why, someone may ask, is such a nonviolent civil society-based movement such a strategic threat to a nuclear power that's supported by the world's only superpower? I mean, Netanyahu, in his AIPAC speech last year, mentioned BDS 18 times, second only to Iran, as the biggest threats facing us. So you would want Iran and its supposed nuclear threat and BDS? Weird. But it's not that strange if you look at Israel's power structure. Yes, Israel is a very powerful country with nuclear weapons. Even economically, it's very powerful, mostly thanks to your tax money, and German tax money, and French and British and others. Yet, Israel's power structure was not designed to face challenges from nonviolent movements like BDS. They don't know what to do with us. So when we pressured Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to sell off their shares in G4S, the largest security company on earth, because of its involvement in the occupation, what can Israel do? Hijack Bill Gates? I mean, so that's, you reach the limit of Israel's power. Really, they cannot face such a challenge. When we convinced the largest pension funds in the world, some of the largest pension funds in the world, in Norway, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, to divest from Israeli banks and companies that are involved in the occupation, Israel could do absolutely nothing. When large European corporations decided to abandon contracts to build Israeli ports, what can Israel do? And so on and so forth. When student councils across the University of California system and across the country start adopting divestment against Caterpillar, HP, Veolia, and so on and so forth, what can Israel do? So we are testing the limits of Israel's power, and we're pushing back against their iron wall that they've built in many of our heads, including in this country. Many in this country believe that this is an animal that you should not touch. You don't mention Israel, you just stay away from that problem, because anything you say, you might lose your job, you might lose your career, you might be isolated. Well, we're proving otherwise. SJPs, Students for Justice in Palestine, Super, in this campus, and many, many student groups across the country, Jewish Voice for Peace, and many partners are growing tremendously and challenging this hegemonic discourse. We've also seen a lot of academic and cultural boycott successes in the last few years. Academic associations across the United States have adopted a full academic boycott of Israel, including Native American and Indigenous Studies Association. Of course, American Studies Association, and many, many, many others. So it's growing. That has shattered the taboo that you cannot mention even boycotting Israel in this country and get away with it. This is so 2 years ago. Today, life has changed. Today, it's okay. It's very controversial, but it's no longer taboo. It's no longer taboo. Yes, we are calling for a full boycott of Israel, academically, culturally, economically, financially. Part of what we do is intersectional work, cross-movement work. And I think that's part of the success of the BDS movement. It's not a narrow, nationalistic type of movement that sees Palestinian rights, Palestinian freedom, justice, and equality as out of context, as separate from struggles. Because many people have many other things to worry about. Why should any American, who's not in the top 1%, worry about Palestine? Why should they even be concerned about Palestine? You have so many problems in this country, you don't need me to tell you. Public schools are being shut down, health services, pensions are disappearing, and so on and so forth, while the U.S. can spend hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars killing people, mostly brown people, obviously, across the world, for the oil companies and for the homeland security companies and for the military companies and so on. Why should any American care? Well, there are many reasons. Today, as South African jurist John Dugard said, Palestine has become the litmus test for human rights in today's world. As South Africa was in the 70s and 80s, today it's Palestine. This is at the front line of our collective struggles against empire, against corporations, against the pillage of the resources of the world. Second, because it's your tax money, mainly, that has enabled Israel to continue and expand its regime of oppression against the Palestinians, our oppression has made in the USA written all over it. That engenders a responsibility. To offset what your tax money is doing, people have the responsibility to act, to end complicity of their unions, their churches, their institutions, and eventually their government in this system of oppression. So there's a deep moral responsibility. Martin Luther King Jr. said that boycott at a very basic level is withdrawing support for an evil system or policy. So it's not a heroic act. Stopping your partnership in crime is not heroic. It's a basic moral obligation. When we ask the United Methodist Church to divest from companies that are enabling the occupation, we're not asking them to do something heroic. We're asking them to fulfill a basic moral obligation. And that's how we should view things. So we challenge Jabotinsky's Iron Wall and all the other iron walls, metaphorical or real, with hope based on action, hope based on reflection, hope based on resistance to oppression. To end, I'll cite a poem called Message to the Living by Henk van Radvig, a Dutch poet of resistance against the German occupation of World War II of the Netherlands. He wrote, "A people giving in to tyrants will lose more than body and goods. The light will be extinguished," end of quote. On Sunday, September 14, 2014, a few weeks after the end of Israel's massacre in Gaza, and despite all the death, destruction, and trauma, hundreds of thousands of Gaza's children almost literally rose from under the rubble that much of Gaza was reduced to, and went with enthusiasm to their damaged schools, carrying their dusty books and injured souls. Their eyes were shining with hope for a dignified life. BDS empowers Palestinians and worldwide supporters of a just peace to keep this hope alight. Thank you.
Following the formal part of the lecture, Omar Barghouti continued in a question and answer dialogue with the audience.
In a nutshell, the Palestinian BDS movement defines normalization as any relationship between a Palestinian/Arab side and an Israeli side where two conditions are not met. When the Israeli side does not recognize our rights under international law, our comprehensive rights under international law, or the relationship itself is not one of what we call co-resistance. In other words, the Israeli side has to recognize our rights, and the relationship has to be joint struggle to end oppression. It's not enough that they recognize our rights. It's important to work to end oppression. Any dialogue that does not have those two conditions is unethical dialogue. It's a dialogue between a master and a slave, oppressor and oppressed, to make oppression look more palatable. And we oppose that as unethical. We want ethical coexistence, which can only be built after ending oppression, not despite oppression. BDS supporters not supporting BDS goals, that's not possible. They wouldn't be BDS supporters. BDS supporters choosing to target a specific very selective target, that's one thing, which is we're fine with, because BDS is based on context sensitivity, which means activists in any context decide what best to target, how best to form alliances against that target. But one thing is not negotiable, the three basic rights: ending the occupation, ending the racial discrimination, and the right of return. That is not up for discussion, because those are our minimum rights that the Palestinian people are entitled to. The Jewish state issue, I'll just go very briefly on that. If Israel, in fact, adopts this law that looks at itself as a Jewish state, it would be furthering entrenching its apartheid status. So Israel would be passing yet another very important law that drops the very last mask of democracy. ISIS, the Islamic State, ISIL, other names, we think that the U.S. and Israel are benefiting a lot from this ISIS phenomenon. Regardless, regardless whether Hillary Clinton was accurate or not, that the U.S. intelligence community created the beginnings of ISIS. Well, they created Taliban, they created Al-Qaeda, so why not ISIS? I mean, after all, who created bin Laden? It was the U.S. in Afghanistan. So that's history. Regardless, we don't have conclusive evidence, regardless who's benefiting from ISIS. One thing is for sure, that tens of thousands of victims of ISIS are brown Muslim Arabs, predominantly. We are the main victims of this genocidal violence that ISIS is committing. No one in the right mind in our region supports this abominable savagery. That BDS is based on strategizing, prioritizing, picking a specific target. There are three criteria for picking a target. First, the level of complicity. The more complicit it is, the easier it is to target it. Second, intersectionality. It's better to target something that offends several communities. So G4S is involved in private prisons in this country, the wall with Mexico, as well as Israel's prisons and checkpoints, perfect target. Something that violates indigenous rights in this country as well as Palestine, perfect target. So that's the second, intersectionality. The third is the possibility of success. We're not romantic activists. We want success. We only do it in order to achieve our rights. So we don't do it for fun. Sometimes it is fun, but we don't do it for fun. We do it to achieve our three basic rights, and that's why we have to keep our eyes on the ball. Can we win this campaign? If we can't, we keep it for a better day. Example, Intel. Intel is deeply complicit. We cannot win against Intel because it's nearly a monopoly. It's not off the hook, but we keep it for a better day. We target companies that we can win, build momentum, and move on. Hani's question about the implications of equality for Palestinians on U.S. interests. Thank you so much, Hani, for asking this question, because there is no U.S. interests. Let's define it. Is it the 1% or the rest? For the 1%, U.S. interests are the interests of oil companies, military companies, homeland security, banks, and so on. Certainly, Israel serves their interests. When people say Israel is good for America, it is for the 1%. For the 99%, Israel is horrible. It starts a war every couple of years, Israel showers it with billions of dollars, and so on and so forth. So which America are we talking about? So it's not exactly that Israel is running U.S. foreign policy. Some very powerful people in the U.S. want Israel because it's serving their interests, but it's not the interest of the people.
That was Omar Barghouti speaking at Portland State University. Finally, on April 3rd, Omar was allowed to communicate with the outside world. He immediately wrote the following letter to his international community of supporters. Dear friends and colleagues, finally I was allowed to access my mail account after 12 days of being banned from doing so during the most intense phase of the ongoing interrogation I am subjected to by the Israeli authorities. Due to a gag order, I am not allowed to delve into any facts about the case. I am thus denied the ability to even refute the vicious lies published by Israel's regime against me. I am in no hurry to do so, though, as their main objective, attempting to tarnish my reputation and, by extension, hurting the BDS movement, has clearly failed. Their campaign of repression has, to an extent, backfired. By preventing me from traveling to the U.S. to receive the Gandhi Peace Award jointly with Ralph Nader, Israel's regime has inadvertently increased the publicity around this award. Before anything else, I read the many moving messages of solidarity that many of you have sent, and this gave me even more strength and hope to resist the McCarthyite witch hunt against me. I deeply appreciate your letters and the sincere sentiments of support that you convey. I am so grateful to everyone who wrote an article and every organization that issued a petition in this respect. Nothing empowers human rights defenders facing political persecution like the warm feeling that there is a whole community of activists and people of conscience standing with them and carrying on the struggle no matter what. For more than a year now, my colleagues in the BDS movement and I have been warning about the tarnishing unit established by the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs as a key organ in fighting BDS. As I have personally written and argued many times, this devious unit's key function is summed up in digging up dirt against human rights defenders and networks associated with the BDS movement, and if no dirt is found, in fabricating it. McCarthy would be proud of his loyal heirs in Israel's regime of oppression and repression. Many of you have asked how best you can support me to face this latest persecution. My answer is, without hesitation, more BDS. We need to expand mainstream and build on our many inspiring BDS campaigns, academic, cultural, and economic, as the most effective way to respond to the new McCarthyism designed by Israel's regime of occupation, settler colonialism, and apartheid, and exported to states where its lobby groups enjoy massive influence. Further growing our movement for freedom, justice, and equality is the answer. Highlighting and popularizing the recent unprecedented verdict by a UN body that Israel is guilty of apartheid, the second most serious crime against humanity in international law, is the answer. Countering their racism, hate, blacklists, and ugly colonial repression with our inclusiveness, categorical rejection of all forms of racism, and our boundless passion for freedom and justice is the answer. Further strengthening our principled intersectional alliances with movements for indigenous, racial, economic, social, gender, climate, and other forms of justice is our loudest response to their xenophobic, far-right, fascist-leaning agenda and their draconian laws. As they desperately attempt to sow fear and despair, to chill our free speech, to tarnish our records, and to bully us into silence, we nourish our well-founded hope with generous doses of effective, strategic, morally consistent campaigns for justice and equality, and insist on our right to freely express ourselves and to defend our rights. As humans, we need permission from no one to pursue our inherent rights. As human rights defenders, no degree of intimidation and bullying can deter us in our passionate, nonviolent resistance to injustice, inequality, and colonial slavery. Alone, we fail. Together, we prevail. The latest savage, even irrational attacks on our movement indicate, more than anything else, that we are indeed prevailing. In gratitude and hope, Omar. That was a letter to his friends and colleagues written by Omar Barghouti following his latest detention by the Israeli military. And that is our program this morning. We will continue to follow the activities of Omar Barghouti and Israel's attempts to silence him in hope of dealing a lethal blow to the BDS movement. But a movement is always more than its leadership, as Israel will soon find out. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.